Well, Tyson, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and there's still even a few people left. I want to start a little bit about kind of how I got into some of the work that I'm doing, looking at cereal rye for a cover crop and looking at reduced tillage. And a lot of this just goes back to where our supply chain is going. And look at this, you know, I've got Walmart, but it's not just Walmart. A lot of our brands and retailers are driving a movement to sustainability. And a lot of the people that are sourcing fiber for their products are looking for responsibly produced fiber or more sustainable fiber. And so those are some of the things that are going on. You know, a lot of this is driven by social media, a lot of things, but here our brands and retailers in the U.S. are really driving a lot of this. This is a page out of the Walmart Global Responsibility Report. But anyway, it's kind of from cradle to grave. And so they're looking at making improvements, you know, not only from the products they source from agriculture, but all the way through the supply chain. And folks, these folks are very serious about this. And a lot of them have goals. I hear a common goal is a 2020 to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20% by the year 2020. Now, some of them have these goals, but they're not real sure how they're going to do it. And so, but they, you know, put their hand down on the table and said, we're going to do it. And so, even with all this said, there's a lot of interest in this, but there's still a lot of opportunities for us to educate people, because people just really don't know where their food comes from. And so we think about, you know, some of the things we're doing on the farm and how that impacts us, but we can't forget about the people that live off the farm as well as trying to help educate our supply chain. So what's the U.S. cotton industry doing about this? U.S. cotton industry's tag team with Australia for a cotton leaves program. It's a business-to-business model. But basically, you know, if I'm wanting to source fiber to produce T-shirts or socks or whatever I'm doing, and I want to have responsibly produced fiber or sustainable fiber, I've got a shopping list. Well, the U.S. and Australian cotton industry want to make sure that our cotton is on their shopping list. And so we need to do those things to keep the demand for U.S. cotton in all the products. And so they're taking the lead on that. Through that, they're involved in Field to Market, which is the Keystone Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture. Here's a list of the members. You can see a lot of folks on the supply chain. There's NGOs on here. USDA NRCS is a member. University of Arkansas is a member. National Cotton Council, Cotton Incorporated are members of this. So it's kind of a team effort. Everybody on this list are somehow involved in agriculture or buying agriculture to get products on a store shelf. You know, if you look at Field to Market, some of the things that they've done is look at, you know, an indicators report. And we see over time in the last 30 years that, you know, look at land use. Basically, that's saying that to produce either a bale of cotton or a pound of cotton, we use 30% less land now to produce a bale of cotton than we did 30 years ago. You skip over to irrigation water use, you see 75%. We use 75% less water now to produce a bale of cotton. Well, part of that, you know, it's easy to get an increase if you're increasing yield. And you can kind of see on land use, that's an increase in yield. But we're also being more efficient. Look at all the things they're done on the southern high plains to be more efficient, the subsurface drip irrigation, the things that we're doing in the mid-south and other parts of the country to be more efficient. And that gets us some of these numbers. But our supply chain says, well, that's okay. That's what you've done in the past, but we want to know what you're doing now. And so that's where the field print calculator comes in. It's an online tool. A farmer can go in and put basically all their inputs in to kind of see what their environmental footprint's like. The metrics that they look at are land use, which is really related to yield. Soil conservation, which is soil erosion. It's they use Russell 2 for water, soil water erosion. They use WEPs in this for wind erosion. They're looking at making improvements on that. Soil carbon is an index, using a soil conditioning index from NRCS. Irrigation water use, bottom line, how many more pounds of cotton that we produce per inch of water over our dry land yield. Water quality is another index from NRCS. It's edge of field water quality. And then we look at energy use and greenhouse gas emissions. Well, there's a lot of different algorithms that were pulled in a lot of different places, kind of put together in this one program. And when I was working with the National Cotton Council a few years ago, that was one of the things that I did. Andy Jordan run a pilot in Louisiana. I was doing a pilot in Texas just to see if it even worked on cotton, what we could do to make it a little more user-friendly. And there's still a lot of places, I think, where people get hung up, a lot of places where we could be a lot better. But it's a start, and it's something that the whole supply chain is in on, and we're doing it as a team. But, you know, if we look at the footprint calculator, it's sometimes when you first look at that, it's not real easy to understand. But I've got the arrow over, on land use, halfway between the center of the spider graph to the edge is our national averages, and the square dots go around kind of a symmetrical pattern. So the national averages are normalized, so they're halfway out on the graph from the center. Then we go in, you can get it to plot your county averages, your state averages, and we can argue about how much faith I have in those numbers. But it kind of gives us a benchmark. But the big thing that I look at is that shaded area in the middle, and that's your footprint for that field. Based on all the things you've done, the amount of energy, direct energy, your embedded energy, all that through all the practices that you do, all your inputs. Now, when we go in and we look at the footprint calculator, and think about what the supply chain want. What does the supply chain want? They want us to be more sustainable. So to be more sustainable, we got to make our footprint smaller. And when we do that, a smaller footprint is more sustainable. Two things that we can do to make that smaller. We can do reduced tillage and use a cover crop. And it kind of takes both of those to make the biggest impact to get to where the supply chain wants. So you know, some of our previous speakers have talked about no-till by itself and no-till with a cover crop. I basically just looked at, what can we do to get the supply chain what they want? And that's no-till with a cover crop. And then what I need to do there, that gets the supply chain what they want. What does the producer want? They want to be more profitable. So do these line up. What can we do to make those line up? I work with a lot of producers. This is one producer down in Deschutes County, Steve Stevens. Everything he does, he looks at, what's my return on investment? How does that impact my bottom line? Well, even before I came to Arkansas, this is him. I think in the 80s. It kind of been early 90s, but this was with stale seedbed. He farmed some ground that's pretty heavy ground. So he'd go in and pick his cotton, shred stalks and hit the rows up, and then he was out of it. But he didn't plant a cover crop. He, hen bit in the Mid-South really grows pretty good. So we used native vegetation for our cover crop. And so that was kind of the program. And I know back in the day when I first started with the University of Arkansas, we were doing Cottonman. And on heavy ground, a lot of times, farmers say, I have a hard time growing a stalk on heavy ground. But on his, when he was doing the stale seed bed, he could, his plant heights were taller, the length of an internodes were longer. It was growing more like cotton on silt loam. And so it was going to the stale seed bed and hipping it up and staying off of it, because that's the heavy ground would mellow out during the winter. And so he was improving soil health and just didn't know it. We talk about, soil health is really big now. We talked about cover crops being old. Most of these, I'm working with three producers now, and all three of them talk about their dads and their granddads used to always plant cover crops. And so, working on improving soil health is something that we've done a long time. And, these are just some of the things that some of our other speakers have talked about on a healthy soil. Now, what we've done is partner with the Discovery Farms in Arkansas, which basically their emphasis or their goal is to look at edge of field water quality. And they just keep track of what the producer does. They don't really dictate what they do. But they've got flumes at the end of the field to measure runoff, to water samples. We've got meters on the well, so we know how much water's pumped on. We know how much water leaves. So there's a lot of data we can get from that. So on one side, we stuck with just a single cover crop. We did cereal rye. And in the Mid-South, glyphosate-resistant palm amaranth, that's, you know, with the allelopathic properties to help us with that, is the main reason we're going with that single cover crop. I know there's a lot of people out there that are pushing multi-species cover crop. And I know whenever I go to salad bar, I don't put just lettuce on my plate. I like a lot of diversity. But still, we're going with just a single crop. And kind of what I've seen over time, when I get a farmer to start using a cover crop, it seems like they try different things, but they always expand. They'll try it on some ground, and they'll try a little more, and try a little more, and try a little more. I think the main thing is just to get them to try it. So anyway, we've got one side kind of a no-till with a cover crop. The other is Steve. We flew the rye on before our initial defoliation, and that was around mid-September. Well, the last couple of years, what have our Septembers been like in the Mid-South? Dry as a bone. And so we flew this on about mid-September. Our basically, our last good rain in September in 2015 was like about the 9th through the 10th. So this set in the field until the first part of October before we finally got a rain to get it to come up. But we got a good stand. On the other side, he did a stale seed bed program. He picked the cotton, shredded the stalks, hit the rows, took a fertilizer buggy, and put his rye seed out, and then run a roller. And you can see the cereal rye is just coming up. Some of our other producers, the farmer standard was just a typical tillage program. And so, but what we did, we were wanting to try to compare the no-till with a cover crop to what they were doing. Some places we had a good bed. And a lot of these places were furrow irrigated. But you know, you're going to lose a bed over time when you go no-till. And we had some places where we had almost no bed. And so thinking about furrow irrigation was a concern that was weighing heavy on us. And we'll talk about that in a second. But down at Steve's, I called him up one day after a rain. I said, "Steve, run out to the field to see if you can take a picture of the two different sides of that field," because each side was about 20 acres. It was a 40-acre field split in half. And where we had the no-till with the cover crop, you know, we talked about greater water infiltration and all that. We're seeing that. If you look at the runoff at the end of the field, the runoff's a lot cleaner. Water's, just not our infiltration with the tillage, even with a cover crop, is just not there. Now, this slide I stole or I borrowed from our entomologists, Glenn Studebaker and Gus Lorenz. They did some work at Mariana this last year. They do a lot of work at Mariana. But Mariana this last year decided to do some cereal rye cover crop work. And Gus, in his experiments where he was looking at thrips, he had some with cereal rye and some without. In this case, the cereal rye was not standing. It was laying down. But he had much less thrip pressure, almost no thrip pressure, where he had the cover crop. And I remember when I first came to Arkansas, and it's still standard practice in Northeast Arkansas where we have a lot of sandy soils, for people to go in with air seeders and band their cover crop, and a lot of them use sweet cover crop. They band that in the middle, it's behind a sweet plow, and so in the middles they've got cover crop, and up on top of the bed they don't have anything, so they use wheat on that. But kind of what we've seen on that, wheat, when you get toward the end of the year, wheat is really difficult to terminate. Cereal rye, you just kind of give it a whiff of glyphosate and you take it out, so that's one thing that we like, and we feel like the termination cost is cheaper with cereal rye than it is with wheat. But I know when I first came to Arkansas looking at this, I know Dr. Phil Tugwell used to do a lot of work, and we always thought that the thrips pressure would be so much higher in the cotton with wheat in the middles. Because, you know, what happens to cotton if you have cotton field planted next to wheat? When the wheat starts drying down, the thrips just move out of it. But he was out there, and he was kind of an old school entomologist. He would be on his stool, and he'd watch spiders, and he'd watch all kinds of things going on for hours. But anyway, he felt like that the thrips had a hard time finding it. So I don't know if it's the reflection on the straw. I don't know what's going on. But Gus Lorenz talked about where they had cotton on bare soil, and the thrips, it just must stick out like a sore thumb because they have no trouble finding it. But where we had the cover crop, whether it was standing or laying flat, they basically, you know, it's almost like they couldn't find it. So there's some other benefits there too. Soil health indicators. Excuse me. You know, earthworms, I think, are a good indicator. There's a lot of things. Somebody talked about pulling soil samples out, you know, where the soil was much more mellow, where they had to cover crop and all. But even in fields where last year was the very first year we had a cover crop, I was just surprised at the amount of earthworms that were out there. And I figured it would be a few years before, you know, using a cover crop, before our earthworm population would get up to where we could see them. But I was just completely amazed at how many earthworms we could find the first year we had a cover crop. And so just having living roots in the soil for the organisms to feed on, I think is just tremendous. I had the opportunity to go to a cover crop workshop in northern Iowa. Went to a farmer friend's house, and there was Vince Blake was there. He's a farmer in Canada, Manitoba. Anyway, you need to get on YouTube and Google or search on YouTube "soil your underwear" or "soil your undies." Because basically he buried underwear, and so he's talking about that. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. And I did it toward the end of the year, and we didn't have a lot of rain, and I didn't know how it worked. But the fungi are what, like, you know, he's from up north with corn. He said that's what breaks the corn stalks down. So you put cotton cloth out, and the more fungus activity you have out there, the more it's going to deteriorate your underwear. And so that's kind of something that I can take and show to farmers and make an immediate impact on what's going on. So we're going to do a little more of this. But no-till with cover crop on one side and conventional till on the other side. Also, when I was there, I had a chance that Dr. Jill Clapperton was there. She's from Eastern Washington. But anyway, she was just a wealth of knowledge on earthworms. And I know I've walked through cotton fields before, Fred, and you look on the ground and you see kind of like little piles of leaves and all that, and I thought, well, it's just kind of the way the water moved through and kind of washed some leaves around. Anyway, those are earthworm middens, and you can kind of count those to get an idea. And Phil, you may already know this, but Tina Teague, at her no-till plots that she has at Dud Hill, that she's had a long term, it was just midden after midden after midden, there was just a tremendous amount of earthworms out there. But I never knew that, you know, I've seen that before, but just didn't know what I was looking at. And you can kind of, you throw a PVC pipe that's into a square or a rod to put that out, and you can count those to get an idea of what your earthworm population is, doing a non-destructive count. So anyway, that's really interesting. But anyway, in our plots, when we in the no-till, there were some things I didn't know what we needed to do. The hard pan's not going to go away on its own. So we did some little plots on our no-till side. One of the farmers that I work with has a DMI. I think a lot of the farmers call it a no-till subsoiler. And I think that's very similar to something that I saw somebody had that was on the front end of a planter. But anyway, it runs pretty deep. So we run that. See, it just kind of makes a little slit on the top, but it does not cover up the residue, doesn't throw up clods. Because I was very concerned, you go into some of these fields and about 6 inches down you have a tremendous hard pan. Is a cereal rye a deep-rooted cover crop? Is that going to make that vanish? Do we need to do this and transition into that? And, you know, some of our fields that are furrows were really flat. And I know some of y'all grew up on a farm and know what it's like carrying a shovel around trying to get water to run down the rows and all that. But some of those fields are so flat, I didn't know if we'd be able to get water down. And so we purchased, I've got a little six-row now. It's a furrow runner. Perkins Sales up in Missouri makes that, but Johnny Hunter is a farmer up in Boot Hill in Missouri that designed that, and they sell that. So I got that to try to make sure that I could get water down the rows. But the last thing I wanted to do is work with a farmer. I'm only, you know, if he's got two 40-acre fields I'm working on, we got it split in half. Well, he's got 40 acres that's basically given to me. And so I feel bad about asking him to spend a lot of money to retrofit a plant or anything like that just for 40 acres. So we're trying to do some things to make sure that we don't run into a wall and him not want to work with us anymore. But, you know, stepping back and, you know, visiting with people and thinking about what's going on and how we do stuff, this is in the Mid-South. But so in a lot of times you get back and ask yourself, why do we grow cotton on beds? And in the Mid-South, Fred, I think getting water off the field is probably more important than getting water on the field. I know when yield monitors first come out on pickers, I thought, okay, man, this is going to be great. We're going to see all kinds of problems, see what the problem situation is. First thing it told us, the biggest thing that it told us, was how good or how poor our drainage was on the field. And when we work the soil and we have almost no soil structure, then we have to rely on external drainage because we have very little internal drainage, especially on some of our silt loams. And so we have to have just a huge, you know, a huge honking bed, as some of the farmers say, just so we can get water off the field. But, you know, if we can go in and improve our internal drainage using a cover crop, using no-till, then we don't have to rely so much on external drainage. And that farmer I talked about in the Boot Hill in Missouri, he goes to a lot of meetings, and he's got a presentation he calls Almost No-Till. And the only tillage operation he does is that furrow runner, so they can have just a little channel for drainage to get water off, and then to get water on. But again, you know, some of our fields were pretty flat and all that. We've seen pictures. One of the big mistakes that I made, and Tom Barber told me not to do this, but one of the farmers I worked with, he shreds his stalks high, and it's really hard. You know, really short stalks will really tear your rubber banding wheels up on your double disc opener planters. So these are tall, but they were standing up, and he was afraid that was going to cause him problems. So we went in and rolled it. And I could not get a planter with no culture on the front or anything like that to go in that. And we just had a heck of a time getting a stand. And I saw Randy Bowman in here earlier. I know the Mid-South is a lot different than they are on the high plains where I grew up and over in Oklahoma. In the Mid-South, a lot of times we work the ground with a do-all or something to try to get it to dry out enough to plant. We got little windows between rain events coming in trying to get our cotton plant. Very rarely do we get a start-to-finish window to get all of our cotton in the ground. And so we're trying to get it in between rains. And one thing between rolling that biomass down and not being able to cut through that, we slowed down almost 2 miles an hour slower. We went a lot deeper on our planter and still only got about half a stand. So I think our stand really hurt us on our yields. But that was difficult. But in Arkansas, I could go out at planting time and take a shovel down, and it's just a solid mass of roots, even a foot down. But it was like a sponge. We terminated this cover crop a month before we planted, and we kept getting rains, and it just wasn't moving. It was just a huge wet sponge. And over on the conventional till side, it dried out, it warmed up. We got a perfect stand over there. And so I think on some of these studies, we've got to wait and plant that later than the other. That's going to make it more difficult to manage the fields, but the time to plant, I think, is going to be different, especially in the real wet springs. And so that's a big problem that we had this year. And this is the almost no-till. You know, when we get in, especially on furrow irrigation, I just don't think we can go no-till cotton. But when we run this rig, the farmer was a lot happier. When we run the water, it did a lot better. Let's see what slide I have. You know, the almost no-till, that was the only tillage operation that we did in our no-till, other than just those strips where I run that DMI no-till subsoiler. Here, he had a stealth seed bed and he used a cover crop, but he covered up all the residue when he pulled his water furrows. When we run the furrow runner, there was still residue on the side of the row, residue on the top of the row. Now, one thing that the farmer thought would happen is, and we've noticed that on the no-till side with a cover crop, water soaks all the way up to the top of the row. On the conventional till side, it just kind of, the first time the water soaks up about halfway, but then a lot of times on the second irrigation, it's kind of slicked off and it just shoots down to the end of the field, and you can water and water longer and longer, and it just doesn't soak up. All you do is fill up the ditches. And so there's some issues there. But he was very surprised, and I didn't know what it would do. But even with the Forerunner making that little trench, the water still soaked up all the way up to the top. And so he sold on it. He said, that's the only thing we need to do. I can seed my rows for next year, and we go that. So I think almost no-till is something that'll work. Oh, here's a good picture of that. See the little trench. Now, we did some that we're running about 4 and 5 miles an hour. I think this is running a little bit faster, and it threw a little more dirt. But the point is it's got two discs on there, scallop discs that pull that out, and a little shovel that cleans out that trench, and then that roller wheel. Try to leave as much of your residue exposed as you can. And here's where I'm talking about, you know, I grew up on the southern high plains, and after an irrigation or a big rain, you'd sink down in the mud about like this. When I first moved to Arkansas, we went out to some fields my first day on the job, right after a rain, and I put my irrigation boots on. Walked out there, and I didn't even get my boots muddy, much less come up over the top of them, or, you know, up over even the top of the foot. So our soils are just so different in the Mid-South than they are. So this year, the last couple of years, I carry a soil probe with me everywhere I go just about during the season. And digging up plants, looking at those. This year, in the no-till, I dug up roots or plants that were working on the second true leaf. And I was finding roots down to about 6 inches. And the plants are only about 2 inches tall. And so we were getting deep roots. And as we get into squaring, this is, I think, kind of where we are, our roots get deeper. But when we go out with a penetrometer and measure what's going on below the soil surface, about squaring, we're starting to get a pretty good resistance building up about between 3 and 6 inches. And then when we get into flowering, we have just a tremendous hard pan. It, you know, you'll mess up your penetrometer trying to get through that 6 inch at flower. And so it kind of runs together. And I noticed that on a field in northeast Arkansas where I was going to do a potassium plot for a new plot, and we needed soil samples at 0 to 6, 6 to 12, and 12 to 24 inches. Anyway, they had harvested the cotton, shredded the stalks, and run a pear till, you know, hip the rows up at harvest. And so I was out there in mid-February, and I could not get a soil probe past 6 inches. And they'd run a pear till. And so it just like it all run together. And I know a lot of farmers have their pear till parked in the turn row. And I think that's probably a lot of it, that they just, you know, it's just not giving them a benefit in our soils. A lot of our soils tend to develop a fragiplan, and there's different things that are going on. But that's kind of what we've seen. But I'm out of time. Looking at some of the results, you know, where we did have our no-till with cover, water did move slower down the road. It was consistently moisture. Where we had no-till and penetrometer readings were lower. 2015, we thought, man, we got this thing figured out. Boy, I had two fields when we looked at the yields, and I think a lot of these are kind of like some of the previous speakers have shown. You know, we've got some numerical differences, but when we look at those, I don't think they're statistical differences. But everything in the field print calculator is expressed on a per length pound of production. And so all of those things kind of run in together. But, you know, we had, about a 175-pound yield advantage to the no-till. So then we go in here last year. We have 5 different fields, 3 different locations. Not so pretty. But when we got to looking at this, the first year we did this, we were in fields where they'd had cereal rye cover crop before, and we started doing the no-till and all that. We had 3 fields this year where this was the very first year they were in a cover crop. And so I don't know if we can put that in the all other category, the allelopathic responses. But when we split this out, the 2 fields that we'd had a cover crop in previous years, there was about 50-pound link yield advantage. When we got to the ones that there was the first time, a big difference. And so I really don't know what's going on there. Again, when we look at the 2 fields that we do have 2-year averages on, again, probably not numerically different, maybe probably not statistically different, but we are seeing some things going on that look promising. Now then, as we go through the season, we keep track of all the inputs, size of equipment, and Archie Flanders is our economist. Those are cotton budgets. We go through the same process to do a budget on this. And again, this is just our operating expenses. you know, there's, you know, we haven't paid rent. There's a lot of things we hadn't paid. There's no cost share on cover crops involved in this. This is just actual out of pocket to grow the crop. We see about 6 cents a pound cheaper. If you look at cost, the operating cost, dollars per pound of lint produced, advantage there. Whether that's statistical or not, I don't know. But again, there's no big penalty. And that, I think that's the main positive thing when we go into this. But then when we look at sustainability measures, we're seeing a big impact on the no-till with a cover crop to the other. And so if that helps us develop our market, supply our customers what they need, and even if they gave us a little extra for this cotton, that we can have documentation for, that would be the better. But kind of trying to balance this between what the supply chain wants and what the farmers want, I think there's some potential for that, and I think it looks promising. So I'm a little bit over, Tyson. Sorry.
Room for one quick question.
Yes, I think it's really interesting on the weed control. We were in fields that we really didn't have a lot of problem with Palmer pigweed. We did have some. We did have to do some hand hoeing, but we went in our farmer standard side and our no-till with cover, and went in after it, just right after the cereal rye come up, and we terminated that. And we did have more weeds in those areas without the cover than we did the other. And I had the weeds, Tom Barber, a weed scientist, come look at that. But, you know, really didn't feel like there was anything, you know, economical on that. But we did see it, you know, if you just go by observation, we did see a little bit of difference on that.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Tom.